Okay, I think we'll get started on our afternoon session. To begin our session, we have Dr. Martin Kroesch coming up to be the presenter. He has talked already and been provocative already, so we can look forward to more of the same.
I can't think of anything better to talk about right after lunch than colon wounds. But that's what we're going to talk about. I have lots of pictures and everything. No, I'm kidding. I do have no conflicts, except I have one conflict about this. This is the pyramid in Memphis. And, you know, there's a Memphis, Egypt. I don't know if y'all were aware of that. It's named after Memphis, Tennessee, even though it's been there for thousands of years. And they built pyramids and whatnot there. But so this building was built for the Grizzlies. Well, actually, it was built in order to try to lure an NBA team there, and the University of Memphis played there, and it's a beautiful facility. It's called the Tomb of Doom. But then, of course, when the Grizzlies came, they played there for a few years, and then they built the FedEx Forum, and so now this has just been sitting there. So in their infinite wisdom, the powers that be are now turning this into a Bass Pro Shop. I wish I were kidding. But this is the artist rendition of what it's going to be. See, there's even going to be a Ducks Unlimited thing there. Colon wounds have been around for a long time, and if you go back and look and see when the first one was reported, you can find it in the book of Judges in the Old Testament. And where Ehud went in and he stabbed the king. The king was kind of a big man, and he left it. He couldn't get the knife out, but he was stabbed him, and the dirt came out. That was the original description. Now, how could a guy get in and with a knife and stab the king, you may ask? Well, you'll note that Ehud is left-handed. And most people were right-handed, so the guards would feel whoever was coming in to see the king, they would feel their left hip, because people that were right-handed would keep their knife on their left hip so they could easily pull it out. He was left-handed. He had his knife on his right hip, and they just missed it. There you have it, dead king with a colon injury. First reported case. Not really very much was written about colon injuries since the book of Judges until the Civil War. And basically, penetrating wounds during that period of time, penetrating wounds to the abdomen were predominantly managed non-operatively for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that anesthesia was sort of lacking, sterility was lacking, and really operating suites were sort of lacking in the battlefield in the Civil War, which we like to call the War of Northern Aggression in Tennessee. But there were huge mortality rates, as one may expect, for penetrating abdominal injuries, and specifically penetrating colon injuries, because nobody got any operations, and people would all die of sepsis. If they were lucky enough to develop a colocutaneous fistula, then they would survive. But other than that, most of these soldiers would die. If they decided to operate on them, they didn't really do much better, because we didn't really understand a whole lot about technique and resuscitation and whatnot. So most of those patients wound up dying. In World War I, the weaponry changed. So there's high velocity missiles, far more destructive injuries. At least we understood a little bit more about shock and we could resuscitate, but still, again, this is in the pre-antibiotic era, and still, there was a very high mortality rate. World War II came along, and so did penicillin. Penicillin saved lives. In addition, penicillin helped a lot of other things that some of the soldiers may have caught during that period of time. But thanks to penicillin, they did come home. The mortality rate dropped from 60 to 70%, now down to about 25% or so. And that's really due to advances in triage and resuscitation, the presence of antibiotics, and the institution of blood banks. There was also an edict that was put out by Major General Ogilvy, who was in charge of the European theater, that all colon wounds should be exteriorized. And in fact, this is a part of his treatise. It was written in 1944. Simple closure of a wound of the colon, however small, is unwarranted. Men have survived such an operation, but others have died. Would still be alive had they fallen in the hands of a surgeon with less optimism and more sense. Kind of interesting way to put it. He was from Great Britain, so that. At any rate, the exteriorization of colon injuries was mandated during World War II. And if a surgeon was caught performing primary repair, then that surgeon was subject to court-martial. Well, as with most things, the war experience then was carried over into the civilian experience, and then many wounds were managed in a very similar way. Woodall and Ochsner from New Orleans realized, hey, the weaponry is a little bit different here in the States than it was in war. Unfortunately, we can't really say that now, but back in the late 40s and early 50s, most people would be shot with handguns, 22 handguns, or maybe a 25 caliber handgun, something like that. Very low velocity, not a whole lot of tissue destruction. And they said that even though that exteriorization is good for battle colon injuries, you need to reevaluate this whole thing in the civilian practice, which is really pretty brilliant for them to make this leap, and they were criticized quite a bit for that, actually. Then there wasn't really a whole lot done since Woodall, if you remember, that paper was published in the early 50s, and then, again, I bring up Harlan Stone, who was years ahead of his time, when he was at Emory along with Dr. Fabian. They were able to create a study where they randomized patients between primary closure and colostomy. Now, if you think about it at first glance, you think, man, I don't want to sign that informed consent. I may randomize to the colostomy group. But what they did was the most critically injured patients had obligatory colostomy, and that's for people who are hypotensive, who lost a lot of blood, who had a bunch of intra-abdominal injuries, who had a lot of contamination, and so forth. So the sickest patients were then taken completely out of the equation. So now we're just looking at people who happen to be shot in the colon or stabbed in the colon without a whole lot of other adverse physiologic conditions, and what can we do for those particular patients? Well, what they found basically was that the patients that randomized to primary repair had a lower infection rate and lower peritonitis and lower leak rate. So they confirmed that the safety of primary repair for colon wounds in selected cases was really the way to go in low-risk patients. Well, what's high-risk patients? Sometimes that's sort of like asking how long is a piece of string, but we can't quantitate who's a high-risk patient to a degree. So then when Fabian left Atlanta and came to Memphis, This was going on when I was a resident, actually. I won't tell you that one of the leaks was my case, because it wasn't. But nonetheless, we started performing primary repair on all patients with colon wounds. Looked at 102 consecutive patients with penetrating colon injuries, and they were, regardless of shock, contamination, or associated injuries, they were managed with primary repair or resection and anastomosis. There were 7 patients that had colostomies. All those patients had associated rectal injuries as well. And so at the time, and still to a degree now, the management for penetrating rectal injuries was mandatory colostomy. So what we found on this particular study is that there are indeed risk factors for intra-abdominal infection, and that's transfusion, contamination, or increased severity of injury to the colon, which is measured by colon injury score. But you'll note that nowhere on here for risk of intra-abdominal sepsis is colon wound breakdown, right? So the contamination that's there from the beginning, from an injury itself, so the guy's sitting there for 45 minutes or so with internal bowel movements until he gets an operation to correct that, that's the trigger for intra-abdominal sepsis. That's what sets the patient up for infection. Not primary repair, not resection and anastomosis for that reason, except for the poor guy that leaked. So it's the presence of contamination in and of itself is not an indication for colostomy. It's an indication for close observation because this guy's probably going to develop an intra-abdominal abscess, but it should not preclude one from performing primary repair. So what we concluded from that is that nearly everyone can be treated with primary repair. Now, what about those patients who have wounds that are not amenable to primary repair, such as people with destructive injuries or associated mesenteric injuries with a devascularized segment of colon? Should we resect them or not? Well, Chapuis in the early 90s said that primary repair resection and anastomosis should be considered for all patients. And that's regardless of severity of shock, regardless of associated injuries, and so forth. However, this generalization was made on a really kind of a small number of patients, 11 patients. Well, I'm sure the power analysis probably wouldn't come up with, oh, you need 11 patients to prove this pretty important point, right? So it's an interesting observation, but I don't think you can make that on 11 patients. So when can you do resection and anastomosis? You know, would we resect and anastomose this patient? I mean, here, internal bowel movements here, there's a little bit of poop on the other side of this lap pad here, but we got out most of it as best we could. So let's focus just for a second on destructive colon injuries. And we actually looked at this, defined destructive colon injuries as wounds that involve greater than 50% of the colon wall, or those who are completely transected, or again, those with devascularized segments. And Ronnie Stewart, who's in San Antonio now, but when he was a fellow in Memphis in the early 90s, looked at 60 patients with destructive colon injuries, and we sort of stumbled upon this, trying to figure out, okay, who can get a resection and anastomosis and do well, and who should get a colostomy? What we found was that people who had destructive wounds plus significant associated comorbidities or significant transfusions, which we defined as greater than 6 units of blood for the purposes of this study, we found that almost half of those patients had a suture line failure. Well, that's pretty bad. If you're putting somebody back together and about half of them are going to fail, that's not too. Those odds aren't really very good. So we were hoping that we could find a subgroup of people who need resection and anastomosis who actually would have a better outcome. What we found was that if you don't have a lot of comorbidities and you do not get significant transfusions, then we've got only a 3% suture line failure rate, which is in a trauma patient, and that's close, not quite as good as elective surgery, but it's at least approaching the suture line failure rate for elective surgery. What do we define as significant comorbidities? You can see here, basically these are immunosuppressive diseases. Now, the problem is not everybody's talking when they come into the trauma center after they get shot in the abdomen. Sometimes they're intubated. Sometimes they just don't really want to chit-chat very much. So we'll never really get 100% compliance with this particular algorithm simply because there's sometimes you're just not going to know what they want. So anyhow, this based on this study, we came up, and previous work, this is what we came up for our management algorithm for penetrating full-thickness colon injuries. If it's a non-destructive wound, primary repair, period. Okay, fix the hole. I personally do colon repair in 2 layers. Some people do them in 1 layer. Doesn't matter. I do small bowel in 1 and colon in 2, but whatever you're comfortable with. If it's a destructive wound, if they have significant comorbidities or they get more than 6 units of blood, they get a diversion. If they don't have significant comorbidities or they get less than 6 units of blood, they undergo resection and anastomosis. That's our colon management algorithm based on this earlier work. Others have corroborated at least the concept that not everybody that we should be careful about doing resection and anastomosis to do in selected cases because there's still room for consideration of fecal diversion in high-risk patients. in a subsequent study that was done out of our place, this was done by Preston Miller, who's one of our former fellows who's at Wake Forest. He's the one that I showed you that sort of bogus abdominal wall delayed closure study earlier. It was a bogus study, but I like Preston. He's a good guy. I'm sure he was coerced into writing that. Anyhow, looked at the next 56 patients who had destructive colon injuries and found that with strict adherence to this algorithm, we were able to decrease intra-abdominal abscess rates, decrease colon wound leak rates, and decrease colon-related mortality. So those are all really pretty good things. So this algorithm now is based on, at least was studied in another... It was constructed based on 60 patients, and then the next 60 patients or so seemed to work pretty well. But again, it's only 60 patients. The AAST did a fairly large multi-institutional trial where they looked at 300 patients with penetrating colon injuries from 19 different trauma centers. Now, I don't know how much y'all have been around trauma people, but sometimes we don't play very well in the sandbox with each other, and I suspect that if you go back and look when we were all little, we were the ones that were probably sent to the principal's office. One time I actually got sent home from kindergarten, but it really wasn't my fault. It was Kathy Lawless's fault. I'll never forget her, and I'll never forgive her for that, because my mother whipped me with every wooden spoon in that drawer. At any rate, she had to leave bowling to come pick me up, for goodness sakes. So anyhow, 300 patients, 19 different trauma centers, and they found that contamination, transfusions, and inadequate prophylaxis were independent predictors of complication. Not particularly surprising that people with a lot of poop in their abdomen are likely to develop an infectious complication. But despite the results of the multivariable analysis, I get to this in a minute, but they made the statement that primary anastomosis should be considered in all such patients, despite the fact that, really resection and anastomosis and leak rate really had nothing to do with outcome, right? That what had to do with interabdominal abscess was transfusions and severity of contamination, as I sort of mentioned before. They didn't really have enough overall resection and anastomoses to make, even though they had 300 patients, they didn't have enough of those particular patients to specifically address that particular issue. They concluded that transfusions were important, but they didn't really recommend to use the number of transfusions for operative decisions. Well, that doesn't really make very much sense, right? If it's an independent predictor of adverse outcome, it seems to me that you would use that as part of your decision-making tree in your head, at least otherwise don't do the multivariate analysis. I mean, either do it and believe it or don't do it and operate on faith-based medicine instead of evidence-based medicine. Either way, that's what they decided on this particular thing, and there was never any standardization of colon wound management. So you got 19 different centers using 19 different management schemes. So even though this was really kind of a nice study, and they were trying to do the right thing and answer a question, unfortunately, even though they had 300 patients, they weren't really able to answer that question. So what we do in Memphis when we can't really come up with any new ideas, we just rehash old ideas and then compare it to what we've written in the past. So this is what we did here. John Sharp, who's one of our chief residents now, I looked at the next 102 patients who had destructive colon injury. So now we've got, all told, about 150 patients, consecutive colon, that had destructive colon injuries that we followed this algorithm. And 150 patients, that's a pretty reasonable number of people from a single institution with the same knuckleheads that have been operating and taking care of these patients for the last 15 years. So at least there's some consistency in the care, there's consistency in the antibiotic prophylaxis, there's consistency in the time of operation, and certainly consistency in the method of repair. So does this algorithm work? Well, yeah, it does. It still decreased the intra-abdominal abscess rate and leak rate and colon-related mortality rate, which obviously is very closely related to the leak rate. So when we studied this, we did the presence... the previous study and compared that to the original study, which was then compared to the original study that Ronnie Stewart wrote back 20 years earlier. Again, very similar populations, with the exception of the number of destructive wounds. And again, I think this represents the change in the weaponry, at least in the Mid-South region, with the evolution of going from handgun violence to more automatic weapons, influx of gangs, even though the Memphis Police Department for years said there are no gangs in Memphis. You know, the whole time they were interviewing the police chief, you know, there's a guy behind him doing gang signs into the camera. There are no gangs here. But nonetheless, so the weaponry has changed. At any rate, our overall algorithm compliance was 90%, which, for the reasons that I mentioned earlier, will never get to 100%. So of 100 destructive injuries, 92 followed the pathway, a leak rate of 3%, eerily similar to what Ronnie Stewart originally published, 30% leak rate if you violated from the protocol. A fair number of people have argued about right versus left and saying that, well, the colony counts are higher on the left side, so you should divert left-sided lesions. Right-sided lesions, you don't really need to. Not quite so sure about that. I mean, poop is poop, if you ask me, but nonetheless, there's some data that suggests that with left-sided lesions that you really shouldn't do resection and anastomosis in those particular patients. And most recently, there was a report out of Emory, which I'll get to in a second. But the group from Denver looked at 100 patients over 5 years, found no difference between right and left. A group from Emory, on the other hand, looked. They had their suture line failures were predominantly involving the left side, distal transverse colon and splenic flexure. So they came to the conclusion that wounds around the splenic flexure should probably be managed with diversion. I'm not quite sure that really holds water. There was a lot of issues with this study, not the least of which was selection bias. But nonetheless, we actually tried to look at that. Again, John Sharp, he had a pretty productive year when he was in the lab, where we looked at 460 patients. A third of the patients had left or right-sided injuries, 29% transverse colon, 14% in the left, and then the rest were in the sigmoid. And then the outcomes, really, it didn't matter what part of the colon was injured. The abscess, leak, and overall mortality were the same. And if you look at the adjusted odds ratios, you'll note that all of them include one. So with abscess, suture line failure, and mortality, it's a wash. So it doesn't matter which side they're shot on or which side is injured. You can manage all these patients the same way. So really, injury location doesn't matter. Non-destructive injuries should be primarily repaired, as we said, and then destructive injuries follow the algorithm. Now, there's a small percentage of patients, about 1%, or a little less than 1%, who have blunt colon injuries. And blunt colon injuries are really kind of a problem. Typically, they're related to people that wear their seatbelt up a little bit too high, and then they are very frequently involving the sigmoid colon that just sort of gets contused. That's one mechanism. The other mechanism is that they have a large mesenteric rent and wind up with a devascularized segment. That typically occurs over on the right side. But these wounds are really kind of prone to ischemia. And I can tell you from good experience, and how to get good experience from having bad experience. But I can tell you that if you wind up doing a resection and anastomosis on a patient who has a blunt colon injury, and you debride the colon back to where you think it looks okay, take more. Always take more. Because every time I've thought, okay, well, this looks good here, and haven't taken a little bit more, every one of those has leaked. So don't do that. Don't pull a Croce and don't resect enough. Resect just a little bit more, and those patients will do much better. So with patients with blunt injuries, we're not really sure, should all those patients get colostomies? I don't know the answer to that. So we decided to try to take a look at that and looked at the number of blunt colon injuries at our place for over 13 years, did basically the same sort of study. We defined, since Since blunt injuries is a completely different mechanism, we included patients who had serosal tears that involved greater than 50% of the colon wound's circumference. They may think, well, gee, a serosal tear, that's not that big of a deal. It's a pretty big deal if you wind up tearing greater than 50% of the colon wound circumference. And those things aren't typically in nice, neat little lines that you inadvertently may make with a pair of Metzenbaum scissors. I mean, these are sort of jagged things. These can be pretty significant injuries. If there's a devascularized segment or full thickness perforations. We've got 150 patients who had blunt colon injuries. Again, if you follow the algorithm, you had a 1.7% leak rate. If you violated it, you had almost a 13% leak rate. Comparing with the penetrating group, it's not nearly as bad because they tend not to have a huge amount of contamination because it's just a different mechanism, but nonetheless, they still get abscesses. And from that data, we concluded that this algorithm, even though it had nothing to do with blunt colon injuries, it's actually pretty durable. You can actually follow that particular algorithm for patients who have blunt colon injuries. And again, there it is. I've included the algorithm in your packet so you can't get away from it, because I'm going to continue to pound this algorithm and how it works. Now, what about in these patients with the open abdomens? Okay, we don't even do this anymore. These patients with towel clipping the abdomen—it's one of those things that seemed like a great idea, just towel clip the skin shut. The problem is, it doesn't really give the patients enough room to swell, and they still wind up with abdominal compartment syndrome, and it's misery. Anyway, so the group from Wake Forest looked at 22 patients that had an open abdomen, and half of those patients underwent resection with delayed anastomosis. And they had zero leaks. So they concluded, based on these 11 patients, that delayed anastomosis is safe in selected patients. The problem is almost half of those patients died prior to hospital discharge, so they were lost to follow-up. But I'm not sure we can make a determination on such an important deal based on 11 patients. At UAB, they had a little over 50 patients. 33 of them had resection with delayed anastomosis, and they had a 12% leak rate. This was written by Jordan Weinberg when he was there. He's a Mayo from Scottsdale product who's now, we were able to convince him to come back to Memphis, so he's back on the faculty now. But their colon-related morbidity for delayed anastomosis was larger than for an anastomosis in single laparotomy, not particularly surprising. So they cautioned against delayed anastomosis in these patients with open abdomens, despite really only having a 12% leak rate, which is really not that bad, especially when you look at the paper from Denver that had 30 patients, 25 of whom underwent delayed colonic anastomosis. They had a 16% leak rate, and they concluded that it was safe. So it's a half empty, half full sort of thing, but these authors drew completely different conclusions. And in fact, if you look at the data, so we go from a zero leak rate, even though half of those patients died, up to over a quarter of those patients leaking. So I guess you can just pick the study to justify whatever it is that you want to do. Well, what about the algorithm? Does that fit in these particular patients? Again, this algorithm was never really designed or intended to use in this particular patient population, but we decided to study it anyway and see, because it's kind of an important issue, really. So again, the same definitions for penetrating and blunt destructive colon wounds. We had 150 patients, 32 of whom had non-destructive injuries. They all had primary repair, and there were 117 patients with destructive injuries. That's a reasonable population of patients. Two early deaths, one of those had a primary repair. So we had 42 patients who had delayed anastomosis and 72 who had stage diverting colostomy done. Okay, so all these patients had their colon stapled off at the first operation, had temporary abdominal closure, and then they would come back at varying time points to have their colon wound addressed. So that's the population of patients that we're talking about, and we're comparing delayed anastomosis with stage diversion of patients. And really, the patients are all the same except for the transfusion requirements in these patients. As one would expect, if you sort of follow the algorithm, even though it wasn't designed for these patients, with those that were diverted, they should have more transfusions, and in fact, they did. if we compare those patients that had suture line failure that didn't have suture line failure, it's very difficult to identify who's going to leak and who's not based on the standard comparative criteria. But then if we compare those that follow the algorithm versus those that didn't follow the algorithm, you can see that those that follow the algorithm weren't hurt as badly, not surprising, and didn't get as many transfusions, not surprising. How did that imply overall compliance? Of course, if you followed the algorithm was low, but again, the morbidity was low, but again, those people weren't hurt as badly, so the morbidity should be lower. But the suture line failure rate, again, very low. Remarkable how this number always seems to be around 3% in this particular population, compared to 30% if you didn't follow the algorithm. So from that data, we concluded that the management of colon injuries in the setting of abbreviated laparotomy, I refuse to call it damage control. I refuse to. It's a personal thing, primarily because Harlan Stone originally described this concept of abbreviated laparotomy about 20 years before the concept of damage control came about. And that's what Harlan Stone called it, so that's what I call it, abbreviated laparotomy. So the setting, it's really not very straightforward. There's a lot of things that go into the division, but this algorithm actually surprisingly sort of works. Why does it work? Primarily it works because it identifies patients that aren't hurt that badly. Right, that aren't in bad shock, that could tolerate this delayed anastomosis. So again, I'll show you the algorithm in patients with colon injuries, non-destructive wounds, primary repair, destructive wounds and comorbidities or significant transfusions, colostomy. No comorbidities, not significant transfusion, delayed anastomosis is fine. So in summary, primary repair remains the treatment of choice for non-destructive colon wounds, regardless of anything else. Primary repair is the treatment of choice for non-destructive colon wounds. If we select patients appropriately, resection and anastomosis is safe, but adherence to a defined clinical pathway or algorithm, whatever you want to call it, that really can result in optimal outcomes for patients with varying degrees of injury and injury mechanisms. I'll leave you with my favorite cartoon. Thanks very much for the privilege of the floor.
Well, practical information that you can take home and use immediately. And Marty, as always, you make the complex simple.